Oscar goes to Slumdog Millionaire, Christian Coulson producer.
Jamal Malik, call center assistant from Mumbai, Chaiwala, for 2 crore 20 million rupees. You were asked who the third musketeer was in the novel by Alexander Dumas. You answered,
hey,
Aramis, which is, I have to tell you, the right answer.
Welcome, and thank you for listening. I'm Luke Shoemaker.
And I'm Zach King.
And this is And the Award Goes To, a podcast that breaks down each Best Picture winner from this century's Academy Awards. Last time, Zach and I were calling a coin flip with Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men. This time, we are playing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in Slumdog Millionaire, diving into a movie that jumps back and forth in time quite frequently. Zach, what are your favorite films that deal with this type of kind of time manipulation?
So, Luke, you have no idea how hard this was to research, honestly, these type of films, because I can think of a few from memory, you know, that are really good. But most of the time when you get into just films dealing with multiple characters over an extended period of time, or three different actors playing the same character, that we see in a great film like Moonlight. So that's one that comes to mind immediately. Moonlight compares extremely well to this, with three characters playing one person. You see that done twice, I think, in Moonlight, and then with this as well. So that's a pretty good crossover. And then Pod alum film we've talked about, The Green Mile. You don't get three characters, but you get two characters playing different people, and that has a devastating effect. So, and another thing, I think with de-aging technology, you know, kind of like we see in The Irishman, even though I don't think it looked the best on Robert De Niro, but neither here nor there, I think with that coming around, you're kind of seeing less of the multiple actors playing one character across, you know, a long period of time from childhood old age. You're just going to see less and less of that with technology as is.
Right. If they can make Grand Moff Tarkin look like he's still alive, they're going to be able to do a lot of things.
And look like 10 times better than, you know, the crap I just mentioned. So
yeah, it's Rogue One.
Yeah, he looked a lot better than what they did with Bob and The Irishman, but rant over there. Why don't you get into the film, Luke?
We'll get into our reflections here. It's how we felt the first time we watched it, our big takeaways. So I went and watched this. I had finally met you on a movie that we're going to talk about. I had finally met you, and I watched this in theater during Christmas break of our freshman year in college. And, you know, I watched this a day after the Hogs upset the numbers, 2 Sooners in Bud Walton, baby. But, you know, I went and watched this by myself because there was no one I knew that I discussed it with that had any interest in watching it, because it was a very different film. And, you know, as I watched it, though, I thought it was a pretty unique concept. You know, there have been a lot of movies that have dealt with game shows, and even ones that had cheating in a game show. But, you know, it just took me back to when Millionaire was such a nationwide craze, and I would sit around, and even my dad would sit and watch Regis Philbin with us, and like, who's going to win it? You know, who's going to win the million? And here was this version with this younger man that was coming from nothing, and it had this jumping timeline, and I loved it. And when it came out, I rented it as soon as it came out to watch it again. And then on this rewatch, after watching it on HBO Max, I still enjoyed it. It's very entertaining. It's not as great as I once thought it was, but I was still caught myself rooting for Jamal, you know, to try to win the money, to get the girl. I liked the time jumping. I thought all three versions of the actors the children actors, I thought they did fantastic. I can only imagine what it's like to try to, you know, keep those kids focused to do those scenes. I still think it was a fun watch. And I'll go into further detail about what I didn't like about this film. But it's enjoyable. And when we're talking about film, I think that's the goal, is for you to enjoy the experience and for it to make an impact on you in some level, and, you know, so you feel moved. And, you know, it has a happy ending. We haven't had a lot of films with happy endings lately, and this has one. And I'm old school. You know, I'd prefer to watch a film in the theater and leave it feeling fulfilled. And I was fulfilled on this rewatch. But look out, because there's a few others in this pod at the end where I really felt fulfilled.
No doubt. No doubt. So, you know, I remember vividly learning about this film and that it was a contender leading up to this Academy Awards season. And I was kind of shocked because I didn't really know anything about it. So unlike you, though, Luke, I waited until it had an early release on DVD before the Oscars in February. It was really weird. So it came out, you know, I watched it. And at the time, I really did think it was a fascinating story about love and just the lengths to which one person's going to go to fight for that. And, you know, I was really struck by this kind of heartbreaking portrait of India, you know, a country that's as beautiful and mysterious as any, but not without its problems, much like the US. So, and kind of like you, these really cute child actors really hooked me in from the beginning. And for a show that I'm going to admit, I was obsessed with Regis, you know, back in his heyday and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, just a great show. I was watching it all the time with my family as well. So I was just captivated by building the entire story around Jamal's appearance on that game show, a game show I hadn't cared about for years. So, you know, the journey through time we take with these three sets of characters playing the same three people, it's an unbelievable feat when you pull that off in the right way. And I think using young actors from the same location as where they're shooting, so being from India, that only adds to the mystique and difficulty in pulling off great performances. And I really think the younger actors did that, along with Dev Patel. And as I've aged, you know, kind of like you, and I kind of see how this film kind of strongly disrespects the country of India in a lot of ways. And, you know, the title alone, referring to India as kind of one big slum. And, you know, to escape poverty, there's only a rags to riches way to do that. So, you know, that doesn't age well at all. So this is in no way accurate or reflective, I think, of India, but I really do appreciate the performances of the three bands of actors and just kind of the epic journey of the love story. Cause like you, I appreciate a good love story with a happy ending in that sense,
you know.
But
he was like this close. He kind of hinted that India had grown when they were older, when Salim's like, you know, our slum used to be right there. If mm-hmm. if he had tried to show a vision of growth for India in a larger scale, like in the middle one, showing their growth, because like they have one of the fastest growing gross domestic products year after year. And it's like, you had these dive back in, you could have easily shown, and he only had that like one line to kind of talk about it.
It's one of your criticisms you're going to get into with character development that goes into what you're saying. So I'm with you.
Attention to details. And this one's wild, as we discussed director, cast, writers, cinematographers, box office numbers, and just its total nominations and wins. Gets 10 nominations, which it wasn't the most for that year. You know, our guy ended up with 13 with Ben Button. Just look at the list. Go ahead and tell our listeners everything this won. It just blows my mind.
So it wins 8. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Score, Best Original Song, Best Sound Mixing, and then Cinematography and Editing. Ben Button only wins 3, and I want to point out two things. The Dark Knight had 8 nominations, Luke. No Best Director, Best Picture category, as we know. Ben Button was Fincher's first Best Director nom. His first.
Yeah. That's like we talked about with Zodiac. That's just wild. I mean, what's wild with Dark Knight is that it gets the 2 wins out of the 8, and it didn't get cinematography, and this got cinematography. That's the other thing that was mind-blowing to me.
Dark Knight was nominated for cinematography, right?
Correct.
Okay, it did get the nom.
It got nominated, did not win. I think its other win outside of Ledger, I think, was sound editing. And this got film editing.
Yes, I believe you're correct.
Crazy. So, limited release November 12th of 2008, and then release worldwide. It's one of these trends where you start releasing around Christmas time, so December 26th of 2008. Domestically, 16th out of movies that year with 141 million, only 378 million worldwide. We start getting into this trend where if you're winning this award, you probably didn't make a lot of money.
That, and I think we're getting back into that, releasing it closer to February, releasing it as close to the deadline in December as you can for the recency.
Oh, yeah.
Could be wrong.
Well, no, I mean, talk about the quick release to DVD. They weren't caring. And that's another thing, for box office numbers to get $370 million and you got into DVD 3 months later. That's pretty wild.
Another crazy fact I read about this, movie almost went straight to DVD. I kid you not. They almost didn't have distribution for it.
Wow.
Right.
Then you don't win an Oscar because you weren't shown in a theater.
Wouldn't have won anything.
Yeah, that's insane. Our director, Danny Boyle, wins for this. He gets nominated 2 years later for 127 Hours. What an interesting career. He has the cult classic Trainspotting. I wasn't as big of a fan of the sequel. Critically, that was well received, though. He goes on, he does A Life Less Ordinary with Ewan McGregor again, which, by the way, I want you to look up the cover art for that movie, because it almost looks the same as the cover art for this. He does The Beach with Leo, 28 Days Later. You know, we've had a couple directors who won an Oscar on their first movie, but this is such a strange filmography, because after 127 Hours, he doesn't really work on anything besides like the 100th Steve Jobs movie we've got. And he directs the 2012 Olympics opening ceremony. He recently had the movie Yesterday. But this is the strangest career I've seen thus far.
You think so?
I mean,
it's hard to argue that it's not, honestly, because I'm going to be honest, Luke. I think he's talented, but I'm not a big fan of his films. So The Beach is a film people love to ridicule. I think Leo's good in it, and Tilda Swinton's in that. Do you remember that? She's the one who stars opposite him. So not the best movie, but I think the performances are fine. And then did you watch Sunshine, his movie with Cillian Murphy, the space movie?
I have not.
Interesting concept. Alex Garland wrote it, the devs guy. So it's an interesting space movie. And I don't like 127 Hours, and I didn't like the Steve Jobs movie. So he just doesn't have many movies I like. But his next film, he's getting back into the big budget studio film. He's got a film coming up with Michael B. Jordan, and it's based on a biblical story.
Oh, nice. Is it sad I almost like the 60 Minutes expose over the 127 hour story more than I liked the movie?
I did too. I mean, we're probably not alone in that.
You know, this takes us, we're just going to follow a similar path here as we get into our writer, and another man from the UK, Simon Beaufoy, three-time nominee, though. Three-time Oscar nominee, wins for this, gets nominations for Full Monty, 127 Hours. His first, you know, like, feature film was also an Oscar nomination. Then he doesn't really pin anything that I have actually seen, nor if you pull it up on IMDb, they don't even have a cover art until 2004 when he does Yasmin. He writes this, 127 Hours. I think this probably gave him more steam in his career because he does Hunger Games, Everest, and Battle of the Sexes. But like, he's only done 15 movies. He has three Oscar noms. And yet if I showed you this name or his filmography, you would have no idea who he is.
Outside of the movies he's done with Danny Boyle, and I recognize Battle of the Sexes and Everest. I'm not a Hunger Games fan, so that's why I didn't mention that.
And I had no idea. I would have not. I mean, you're adapting an already existing book. That doesn't necessarily mean it makes it easy. But when it's talking about young adult fiction, people were going to go regardless. I hate to knock that franchise, but people were going to go.
Yep.
That takes us into our cinematographer, Anthony Dodd Mantle. Just another guy that just doesn't have a lot of blockbusters. He's worked on 25 movies before this. Last King of Scotland and 28 Days Later is the only thing that really jump off the page. He, once again, obviously, these all three guys like to work together because they're on 127 Hours. He's done Rush, In the Heart of the Sea, and Snowden. He wins for this movie, but never nominated again. I will say I have seen the 2009 film Antichrist with Willem Dafoe, and it's extremely terrifying, and it's not a movie that I want anyone out there that's under the age of 18 to ever watch, but it's actually well shot. It's incredible that men with so little work put together two solid films in a three-year span in regards to accolades. Blows my mind.
I think he's really talented, but like you're saying, look at the films he's done. Doesn't work very often, and he does weird movies, but Last King of Scotland, you know, 127 hours, you know, it's not good. And then this are shot extremely well. He's talented. I think he booked a pretty big gig coming up. I can't remember who the big name director is. So he's around, but a very odd guy.
Yes, 100%. And you want to talk about odd for our listeners. When we get into cast here, it's going to be a lot of names you may have never heard of. But I think that was part of the movie. But go ahead and tell us about our lead actor, Dev Patel.
Yeah, Dev Patel. He's he's actually had an Oscar nomination in his career for Lion, another film based out of India, which I didn't see, but I heard it's actually really good. And I really think he is talented. He's not Indian for our listeners. I believe he's from Britain, Great Britain, originally, and I think he's is he Arabic? He's not. I want to say he comes from the Middle East, or his lineage is Middle Eastern, not Indian, but neither here nor there. Great guy who I this was his Welcome to the Party movie. This put him on the scene, and he really started getting cast again and again after this. And I remember, I think Newsroom is what he booked immediately after this. Got a regular gig on that. Ensemble cast, and it was very popular for a lot of people, you know, Jeff Daniels, Aaron Sorkin series. And I don't know what else to say about him. He's a talented actor, and he's been in some good flicks. You just really have to search his name and you'll remember the movies he's been in.
Right. Both his parents were actually born in Kenya, but in a very Indian culture in Kenya before they immigrated to London. But yeah,
He is Indian.
Definitely talented. The first time I saw him outside of this movie was Newsroom, and I was a huge Newsroom fan, and he fit up to par with a lot of the big names in that cast. Mm-hmm. And then I watched Lion, loved Lion. I thought Lion maybe was better than this. Like, his performance is really solid, and that story is very heart-wrenching. But I couldn't help but think when watching this movie, if they don't find him, does this movie even get nominated?
I agree. It doesn't get nominated. You said it. You don't think it wins without him.
True. But I've kind of segued into, I don't even know if it gets a nom if he's not in it.
I think you're right, because he carries it in a lot of ways. Granted, the younger actors do a great job, but he's the only truly recognizable face, and he did a great job. But this segues us into our leading lady, who also spawned a decent career based off this, Frida Pinto. What can you tell me about her?
So it's crazy, because before this movie, she had only appeared in one short film. And then she gets the part here as Latika, and since then, she's gone on to do Rise of Planet of the Apes, Trishna, Immortals, Desert Dancer, Love, Sonya, Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle. She was young when she got this role. She still has a long career possibly ahead of her. I just hope that she doesn't get lost in some of the Steelheads typecasting her. She can play any role. I mean, it doesn't matter. You can write her into any role. And I thought in what we got of her. I actually wish she had more screen time in this movie.
I agree. She was kind of a hidden gem of the film.
The next guy I love. I just have to say I love, I think it's Anil Kapoor. He plays Prim, the game show host. 8 nominations from the International Indian Film Academy because he's known as a huge star in India, has over 130 acting credits. He's been in the game over there for 4 decades. And I think in this film, he really adds something special. Like, I buy him being a game show host. Like, he had those snide comments that were crucial because as the viewer, every time he kind of chided Jamal, I was like, I hope Jamal friggin' wins this whole thing. And then you get that bathroom scene and the post penultimate question scene where he's calling him a cheater. And this is my show. Like, he sells it. He's good. I enjoyed him. I really enjoyed him in regards to character building.
So he's a Bollywood star.
Yeah. Like, well known, gets, I guess, you know, they have their academy and this is their version with the International Indian Film. And he's won a few, been nominated for a few, and some of the largest box office number movies, he's in them in some capacity. You can tell he's got some flair for the dramatic just by how he plays Prim.
Well, we have 2 villains in this film. It's him and Salim.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Salim is... Oof.
Yeah, I'll get into that.
Yeah, I even though Salim does take part in some of our favorite scenes, the next man, Irfan Khan... you added in that he has recently passed away. Another Bollywood legend, 151 acting credits. I think he's an important piece of the film because you get the great back and forths with him and Patel. And the intensity, and he's so stoic when he asks the questions and he's pounding him on all of this, all the ins and outs. It creates this intensity that you needed. And he's someone with a lot of nominations from that same academy. Tell us some of the movies he's been in that people may have seen.
Well, he has the lead role pretty much, and well, one of the lead roles in Life of Pi, Ong Lee's adaptation, fantastic movie, and he's great in that as the adult Pi. Jurassic World, the first, Chris Pine, is that his name? No, not Chris Pine.
Chris Pratt.
I was close. Chris Pratt yeah. And Bryce Dallas Howard, their first installment in that new franchise. He's pretty darn good in that. I
forgot that. I'm glad you added that. I forgot he's the
villain, pretty much.
The owner of the park.
Yeah. And then he's in Spider-Man, the first installment with Andrew Garfield, the Amazing Spider-Man. And he's pretty good in that as a villain, basically. So he plays a... Yeah, he had a range. Very talented actor. Hate to see him that he passed away this year.
Now, I didn't list the name of the children actors, but you do have a little bit of a fun fact about how Boyle's decision was into paying those actors.
Well, yeah, they just made sure that they set up a trust fund for them. Because pretty much all of those kids, the child actors, came from poverty. So they wanted to make sure and take care of them after the film, especially after the success the film had. To my knowledge, they have done that, correct?
Yeah, the caveat was they set them up at a boarding school that they had to stay in until they were 18. And they paid for the tuition to the school, which is great. I guess some of the controversy surrounding it is that it's not as large of a sum as some had thought. Nor on the front end did they get paid a lot. We talked about Kite Runner last time. I guess those child actors got paid more. But I mean, it's when you reach 18, it's a good fresh start for a life.
Yeah, I think the theory is they're setting them up, you know, education-wise, and they can have a good job. So I hope so, because those kids were adorable.
Oh, yeah, they were great. Speaking of greatness scale, IMDb versus Rotten Tomatoes, are we over or are we under? IMDb is at a flat 8 out of 700,000 reviews. Tomato meter at 91, but a matching audience score around at 90. Where are you at?
7 and 70. This is a solid C for me.
I'm going to blow your mind. Later on, Rev Road, I think, has a 68 on the tomato score. I'm at like a 7.5. My tomato meter, I'm probably mid-70s, 75 as well. It's hard for me to look at it and keep it in the 90s, especially since some of the movies that we've covered already. But I'm going to love this part. Sell this to my dad.
These just keep getting harder. And this one, I keep saying, like, man, I don't know how I'm going to do this. All right, here we go, Marty. Slumdog Millionaire. Marty, if you want a love story based on, like, action, kind of some action to it, you know, some intensity, a good pace to it, and also a trip down memory lane with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, watch this movie and pay attention to the love story and just hope for the best is about all I can tell you.
Let's see if that sells him, but let's get into the breakdown. Whereas we talk about the synopsis and discuss some of the movie, this movie opens in Mumbai in 2006 as Jamal Malik is on the game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the Indian version, and he wants to win the big prize. And it's the final moments of the show. He's one question away, and we get, you know, something I do love in this movie. I do love how they did the subtitles. It's not like your classic, not always the white little text underneath, but how they flash almost like you're in the game show. And the subtitles read, "How did he do it?" And it shows the different answers. It says A, he cheated, B, he's lucky, C, he's a genius, or D, it is written, which in the beginning makes no sense, right?
It doesn't, but it's a fantastic opening with the officer blowing smoke in, you know, into his face and then slapping him and immediately showing the questions with the soundtrack to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire playing. I loved that. I was like, that's how you open a movie. You get my
attention. Yeah. Oh, that's great. And then you get to see on the show. So, you know, he tells the host that he works for this mobile phone company. And it's like your general Who Wants to Be a Millionaire startup. You tell him what you do, where you're from. But it turns into basically the host making fun of his career because he's a chaiwala, which means he's a tea runner. He's an assistant to people making the phone calls. And it's just, if right from the go, you're like, man, I'm rooting for this guy. Like, I want this guy to do well on this show.
Yeah, especially how rude they are to him. From
like the whole audience is laughing at him. It's insane.
He's being tortured, you know, in another timeline. So you're just like, damn, what's going on?
Yes. You know, the scene shifts back to that. You know, you talked about the torturing. And it's this guy's asking, you know, this younger guy asking this older officer, you know, has he confessed yet? And he's like, all I've gotten is his name. And Jamal's hanging up by his wrist from the ceiling. They've got a car battery. They're electrocuting him to try to get stuff out of him. You know, we understand that these are policemen. And when, you know, he's saying nothing, and they're getting impatient. And, you know, one guy's like, what if he did know the answers? And the one guy's like, what the hell can a slumdog possibly know? And now Jamal finally says something and says, I knew the answer. So this finally cues us into, oh, they think he cheated.
Right. All that just to get to that point.
Right. I was like, you know, for the first time I ever watched this, I thought, what's going on? Is he like a terrorist or something? It didn't until that moment. I was like, I kind of
cued in that too. It's like, yeah, they think he's got, I figured he had gotten too far on the show. And yeah, they were thinking that, but still I was like, man, what a brutal way to handle that.
We get a flash to a young Jamal, and he's trying to catch a ball in this game with these guys, with the rest of his friends. Plane flies down and, you know, causes him to miss the ball. Everyone starts laughing at him. Some men go by on motorcycles to, you know, break up the game, and, you know, plane lands at the airport, the boys run away, and they run across these roofs and across their village. And it's kind of setting up some of the backdrop for Jamal and for Salim and what they're kind of living, where they're kind of living at, because, you know, you can see that they live in a kind of impoverished neighborhood. They finally find their mother who gets them to school. And I love that their first lesson they're talking about at school is Alexandre Dumas, the Three Musketeers, because that definitely ties in throughout the movie.
It does. And I'm never, anytime I hear that author and title, I'm never going to not think of that sequence from Django Unchained, but neither here nor there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
I hope you remember what I'm referring to with Christoph Waltz. Yeah.
Yes. Back in the present, though, the older cop, he's sitting at a desk and turns on a television, and basically they start showing the episode because they want to break down. They want to understand what's going on. His first question is, who was the star of the 1973 film Sanjeer? And the film once again flashes back, and oh, poor Jamal is in this public toilet shack, and a man rushes up to the shack and basically falls into a porta potty. Basically, he's covered in crap, and suddenly this helicopter flies over, and it's got this famous Bollywood star. And we see this montage of the various films that this man was in, and everyone in the slum comes running to him, and he gets his autograph. Like, out of everyone there, Jamal runs up there, has the gall to get the autograph while he's covered in crap, and he's so proud of it. And then the whole crowd's disgusted, but it's great that right from go, we understand how he knew the answers to certain questions. Like, that was the guy.
Yeah, it's a cool narrative. Device to string us along with each question. But yeah, I always laugh when he's, I'm a Tommy John!
Yes!
Runs after him.
This is also so where we first start hitting Salim, because Salim sells his autograph to some dude.
Yeah, and makes fun of him for it.
Yeah, for like a couple rupees. It's like like a couple like coins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good old Salim.
Back in the present, the policeman watched Jamal win on the show, and Jamal says, you don't have to be a genius, to answer that question. And the next question, though, it's about the writing that's underneath the three lions that is the national emblem, and Jamal uses his Ask the Audience. And the cop, and once again, people just being, just treating him so poorly, pauses it and says, my five-year-old daughter can answer that question. And, Jamal's clearly pretty intelligent because he fires back and he asks the price of street food or who stole someone's bike last Thursday. And they have no idea. And he says, everyone in my neighborhood knows that, even the five-year-olds. It's like, good for you, Jamal.
Yeah, like when he finally snapped back at them, I was like, all right, I'm tired of you guys' crap.
Right? Steamroll him every time, any chance he gets. I love the kind of depiction. How does he understand? How does he know these answers? And the next question we get, and this one's might be one of the most brutal. It asks about the god Rama, which is in the Hindu faith, and they normally have somebody depicted holding in the right hand. And well, how does Jamal know this answer? Well, in a flashback, we see his mother and he's playing and Celine are playing in this water and they're doing laundry, and the Bombay riots, where essentially the Hindu people attacked any of the Muslims that lived in that area, and not just attack, but they kill their mother. And at the end of this montage, we get to see, they see kind of a vision of the god Rama, and they've got the bow and arrow in the hands. And what a crucial and sad, gut-wrenching quote he says.
Because of Rama and because of Allah, I may or I may have a mother. I may still have a mother.
Yeah.
I don't have a mother.
You'd still have a mother if it wasn't for this religion.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, and that's something that they still fight over to this day, unfortunately, in that country.
That's what's great to just real little bit of snippet about the movie Lion is when he gets separated from his family, he only travels about 2 miles north on a train and they speak an entirely different dialect within India that far apart, which is a good scene. Back to this movie. Geez, it shows... it shows that that man lit on fire and some of the devastation of what had happened with the all the things that happened on that riot. And basically the boys kind of team up with I'm kind of skipping ahead where they tee up with Latika, but during the commercial break, after he gets this question right, they tell him, take the money and run. Like, Prem's like, go ahead and cash out, brother. 16,000 rupee, go ahead and cash out. But they do meet Latika, and they, you know, Jamal immediately is infatuated with her. Salim, not so much. You know, they're out there in the rain, and finally Jamal helps them out, and Jamal adds them to their group, and this is like love at first sight for Jamal.
Oh, yeah. I mean, who can help the kid after what he went through?
Right. Having a lifelong bond with that, with her, I mean, that's something they have forever. She lost her family the same day.
You got Salim for a brother. I mean, yeah, you need someone else to balance out that equation.
We've got a lot of pods where people have bad family members.
It's a recurring theme in these best picture winners.
Right. Jamal gets asked a question about an Indian poet that wrote a famous song. And once again, we get this flash to kind of see how we would know this answer. And all the kids, they're playing in this giant trash heap. And these men come out there and they greet the boys and they give them a Coca-Cola to drink. You know, on rewatch, I forgot how terrible of a person this guy was. Because when they go back to what looks like an orphanage, they're eating all that food. And you see all these kids that are crippled and stuff, and you think, oh, he takes these kids in to help them because they'd have no other way. And then at night, he lines them all up to sing, and you start to see that, oh, maybe he has other alter motives. You know, Salim, who can't sing at all, shows his kind of like grit, which kind of shows it's kind of foreshadowing of what he's going to become. And in fact, the school is literally just a place where these gangsters are trying to get kids to beg for money. It's terrible. I'm going to skip some of this so we can get to it. You know, the night where that one kid's singing in front of mom and he's so great at it, and then they knock the boy unconscious and blind him, I almost vomited like Salim.
A tough watch, and yeah, he's basically running a panhandler's concentration camp for little kids, which, yeah, just tough. You know, you don't want to see bad stuff happen to children in any movie, but
no, I will give Salim credit here though, because the guy sends him to go get his brother, and he basically hatches a plan so that they can all escape, but only Salim and Jamal escape. Latika doesn't make it on the train that they're on. And thus, they're the two musketeers again without their third musketeer. It was pretty sad when she didn't make the train.
Yeah, I thought Salim kind of pushed her too, didn't he?
He did kind of, yeah, he was in for himself there. He was kind of being a selfish jerk.
He kind of made sure she didn't make it, which was, yeah, some crap.
Yes. You know, and they fight about it. They definitely fight about it when they get on the train. They see all these other men that are sleeping on it. Back in the present, though, Jamal gets the question correct because he knew who wrote the poem, because all the kids were forced to sing that song back at that place. So he's up to 250,000 rupee. What's crazy about the next sequence is the boys are traveling and they're making money and they're basically hustling at age 8 is a are on these train like vagabonds. And after a while, though, they end up at this place when they fall off the train, and out of all places, you end up at the Taj Mahal.
Yeah, and I like them rolling off and then turning into teenagers, the two new set of characters we get. That was pretty cool.
Great transition. When they arrive at the Taj Mahal, their next con is they start acting like they're tour guides to other tourists, just completely fabricating everything they can about the Taj Mahal, which is a fun scene. It's hilarious. They're just stealing shoes. They're selling stuff. They're grabbing wallets. They're doing all this stuff. And, I mean, I guess essentially they're doing what they have to survive at such a young age. I can't imagine myself being able to survive like that.
Absolutely not. And, you know, obviously this film points out that India has some rough conditions, but I don't know. I'd wonder how prevalent that is.
Yeah, true. Very true. Back to the show, though. The next question had to do with who's on the $100 bill, and Jamal stalls before saying the correct answer. But in the interrogation room, You know, the policeman pulls out a bill and asks Jamal, it's an Indian bill, and he asks Jamal who it is, and he can't answer, and the guy's like, it's Gandhi. It's Gandhi. How do you not know that it's Gandhi? But here's where I kind of pause. I know several Americans who mess up who's on what in regards to currency. They won't know. Some who believe Benjamin Franklin was a president. Some that, you know, don't know Alexander Hamilton wasn't a president, you know, yet he's making fun of him. So, you know, that's
it's just an overlooked thing.
Yeah, I guess it is what it is. It is. It's sad on the story on how he shows how he figured out that it was, you know, Benjamin Franklin. We get to see the boys are back in Bombay or Mumbai. It's now Mumbai. They're working at this restaurant. I love that in the restaurant, someone orders mineral water and they just refill a bottle with faucet water. You know, they hate working there. Salim talks about his disgust at how he doesn't want to, basically, he doesn't care about Latika, forget about her. But Jamal, he continues to look for. In fact, he sees one of the boys who was blinded by Mamin, and he gives the boy a $100 bill, and the beggar asks who's on it, and Jamal says it's some president, it's some guy with the white big hair, blah blah, this, that, and the other. And the boy says, oh, it's Benjamin Franklin. And thus we know Jamal knows the answer from that. But he does give him some insight to where Latika is. So he says he owes it to Latika. And they go to the street, and it's called Ask for a Girl Named Cherry, and they find her, and essentially she's what? What do you think she is, 14, doing this dance in front of this man?
Yeah, I'd say so.
But this leads to a pretty powerful scene, because Mamin walks in, and the boys are trying to steal her, and Mamin, you know, he recognizes them, and he's not going to let her take her, but Salim pulls out a Colt 45, and I forgot that he just blows Mamin's brains out.
You forgot that?
I don't know why I forgot that. It had been probably 9 years since I watched this, or eight. And for some reason, I thought he shot the bulldog, the bigger like henchman of Mamin. And for some reason, I thought Mamin was the guy, Javed or whoever, at the end. Clearly not, as he absolutely kills Mamin instantly.
It's his kind of transition into the full villain role of the film.
Oh, yeah. That's when you start to see. It wasn't even without a blink of an eye that he shoots him. Of course, back on the show, the question was who invented the revolver, which Salim knows, and he answers Samuel Colt. They run to this abandoned, you know, flash to the kids again, are now teenage kids, and they go to this abandoned hotel, and then they're kind of getting drunk, and Latika and Jamal kind of have a moment, and Salim wanders through the streets, and he finds who essentially was Mamin's competitor. And he pulls out the revolver and tells some of the guys around there, like, I killed Mom and I'll kill you too. And Javed's like, sweet, yeah, I could use you in my gang. And he essentially offers him a job. I guess Salim kind of just thought this was his only out, right?
Yeah, he was just wanting to embrace that lifestyle, I think, because of what he perceived the money that would come with it and the power, maybe. I don't know.
True.
Okay. Not a good person.
Yeah, the next part really shows that, because back at the hotel, you know, he's pushing Jamal around. He closes the door on his face, and it's just him and Latika, and he demands some, like, you know, it's kind of hints that he wants her to have sex with him. He knocks Jamal out. Jamal comes back, basically they flash forward to present, and the cop said, did you ever see them again? And he says, I wouldn't be here if I had, which is so sad. I mean, it's a lie technically, but you know that he had to live on his own after that point without his brother and the girl he loved.
Just a brutal turn of events for our boy Jamal Malik.
Yes. The policeman, though, they're not sold. Not really sold. And they want to really charge him with fraud. And he says, listen, when someone asks me a question, I tell them the answer. And they kind of ask, well, how did you even get on the show? And I love this scene because it shows at his work how everyone there calls in at the same time to try to get on the show. And this, but this at the same time points out to something that you talked about, that it's essentially stating that the only way to get rich in the country is to win Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Because even these people who have jobs are calling in there. This is, however, how he finds Salim after all these years, because he searches him in their database. They have a quick phone conversation. But it does show through his workplace, the reason he knew about Cambridge Circus is because the different sections in his work were marked off with those locations. In a flashback, we get to kind of see that Jamal and Salim had met up and they're at this construction site. We get this like dream of Jamal's of throwing Salim off the roof. And then he, you know, he fantasizes that. And then we pull back to reality and he yells at him and he's, you know, he's felt betrayed. His brother abandoned him when he needed him the most. The whole high rise setting, pretty powerful, but I still hate Salim.
Yeah, I do. I was excited when he like tackled him off, but I was like, oh, you went with him. And then I realized it was, you know, a dream, but then he actually does punch him, which is good of him.
He knocks him on his back. Yeah. Like he's good job.
Little revenge.
Yeah. And you know, he goes home and he sleeps with at Salim's house and Salim gets a phone call and it's obvious that, you know, Salim's working for this guy and, you know, Jamal follows him, but eventually Jamal finds Latika. And he tells her he loves her, and he sees that she loves the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and he wants her to leave Javed, and she's not – I mean, she thinks that she can't, that there's no point, that he needs to move on, but he says, meet me at this train station every day at 5, and this is like right as Javed had arrived. Luckily, they pull off a lie, but she eventually throws him out and says, it's too late, Jamal, and closes the door. Back on the game show, though, the host asks a question about a famous cricketer who had scored the most first-class centuries, and we flash back to Jamal. He's riding that train, and Latika does show up, and this is this constant like flashback that he always happens throughout the movie. He calls over to warn her, but she gets captured by Salim, who cuts her face. What a douchebag.
Just reinforcing a theme of this film that everyone is awful besides Jamal and then ultimately the captain that releases him from police captivity.
You're right. Yeah, it's rough. You know, the scene shifts back to the show and we get this commercial break and both the host and Jamal go to the bathroom, which I don't really think they would do on a real game show. I think they would probably have separate, like he'd have his own and Jamal would have his own. And Prem kind of talks about like, I've came from a slum as well and I'm a millionaire. And he tells Jamal that he's going to win. And he says, trust me, it is written. And, you know, before Jamal leaves the bathroom, he looks up on the mirror and because of the steam from the fog, he sees the Prem wrote, an answer on the board. He gave him the letter that, you know, that he should pick. So when they go back to the show, Jamal does his 50-50 lifeline. It leaves only the answer that Prem had hinted at and another answer. And would you have trusted Prem after all he had done to you? Or would you probably would have done the same thing, right?
It's one of my favorite scenes of the movie. And it shows you really how smart Jamal is. Because, you know, he has that street smarts. He has that sensibility about him to know this fucker is lying to me. He's trying to screw me over because he's pissed not only of how far I've made it, because he basically just told me that story in here, like, you're the only one who's made it this far besides me coming from nothing. So, yeah, this guy doesn't want me to go far. So I loved it. No, I wouldn't have believed him.
No, and what's crazy is he wins 10 million rupees. Back then it was like $200,000. So yeah, right now he's like set. But the host goes on, they're going to the final question of the game. But then the buzzer sounds, which is the exact buzzer from the original show. So when I heard that, I loved hearing it. He calls the host over and Jamal, and they're walking together. And basically, Prem got the cops to come, and they take the cops away, and the director of the show comes up, and he's like, "What the heck are we doing?" And you know, he's a cheat. This is my show. He gave the, you know, I gave him the wrong answer, and he did the right answer. And the guy's like, "You gave him an answer?" And then he just has this huge blow-up scene. But this at least sets up how we know that where how Jamal got to be with the cops in the first place.
Yes, finally reveals the, you know, the shtick behind that. But yeah, I love that sequence of him giving him the fake answer, him figuring it out, and then just the suspense of when he narrows them down and picks the right one, how Prem acts afterwards.
Because yes. Prem's like, B? Jack Hobbs? Are you sure it's not? Did you say D? He's like, even like live on air trying to get him to pick it.
And then when he gets it, he's like, "I never know why." You know, he like really like raises, gets into it and animated.
Like he does his Regis impression. But because of all these stories, the cop says this is bizarrely plausible. And you know, he lets him go. And right before he leaves, he turns around and says, "You know, I got on the show because I thought Latika would be watching." And of course she is. Everyone in the country is captivated by this. They're all seeing him on the TV, and it's becoming a countrywide phenomenon. They want him to win. All these people are rallying behind. It's almost, I bring it like to soccer, how people rally behind their clubs or their country's soccer team in those countries. And they're rallying behind Jamal. But we finally get to see something good out of Salim. He allows for Latika to leave. He gives her his keys and his car. As she leaves, she says goodbye. And it's finally like, good job, Salim. It only took you an hour and a half.
It only took you your whole life to do the right thing. But, you know.
Jamal goes to the studio to answer, you know, his final question. The scene shifts to Latika. She's driving through traffic, and there's tons of traffic. She gets out of the car, and she goes to watch it on this TV in this alley or outside of a shop, because everyone's watching, everyone's captivated. And as the show begins, and you got to think about this, he's just been tortured and probably been up for 24 hours, and here he is for his final question. And it's a crazy final question, because we saw the beginning. The question is, who was the third musketeer? Or who are the three musketeers? And the first two answers that they give inside the question are the ones he and his brother used to call themselves. So we're left wondering, does he know the third? So he actually opts to phone a friend, and he calls the only number that he knows, his brother Salim. But would fate have it, Salim does not have the phone, but Latika does. And right before the producer shuts off the phone call, boom, she answers. And he just wants to know, and this just shows where his mind's really at. He just wants to know she's okay.
Ever more the romantic and, you know, the heartthrob, Jamal Malik.
We get, while this is happening, we get a flashback to Javed's place. Salim has locked himself in a room. He just puts all this money in the bathtub. He gets his gun out. Jamal reads off that question to Latika. She doesn't know the answer. Calls disconnected, so he just guesses an answer. And while this happens, Javed busts in. Salim shoots him and then gets shot. And as he's dying, he's saying, "God is great, but this is while simultaneously, Jamal gets it right." And the confetti falls from his guess, and it's just fantastic moment for the movie.
It is. It's, you know, it plays into that whole love story aspect, and kind of, you know, they wrote this specifically, or that made for TV moment, you know, but it's nice.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the cop said, it's bizarrely plausible. I mean, it's very unlikely a lot of this could happen, but it happens. And what's crazy, you just win 20 million rupees. So you win like roughly $400,000. And you go to that train station, and there she is, and you find her, and you kiss her, and he finishes with, "This is our destiny." And then it just, a complete classic Bollywood goes into their dance number, which is absolutely fun to watch. It is fun to watch.
Yeah, yeah. Jaho and A.R. Rahman designed that song, and I think they won for it. Yeah, that's a Bollywood staple. The entire cast does a dance sequence, I think sometimes several throughout the film. But and I didn't.
Our guy that. Patel is pretty good, even though it's...
Yeah, I do like him out there. The whole cast is out yeah. there grooving. So, yeah, I love it. It's a cool ending. It really is.
So that takes us into favorite scenes. Go ahead and give me one of yours.
Okay. I really like Salim's death scene when he kills Javed after he'd done the right thing, letting Latika go, and he kills Javed and, you know, falls back in the tub full of money and says, "God is great," as he died. I like that. I think that's a pretty cool way to go out.
Yeah, especially as his brother wins, you know, a fortune. And I'm with that, you know, that's one of mine as well. That whole final sequence, just from the moment he sits down and Prim's like, you know, you're going to be a millionaire, aren't you? And he's like, if it is written, like completely throwing it back in Prim's face that I didn't pick the answer that you told me to. And then he passes on the 10 million. He's like, I'm going to play, man. And that whole sequence is just, it was great for the movie.
It was. I love also when Jamal imagines tackling Salim off the high rise, and then instead of that, he punches him because, you know, I was ready for him to do that for a long time after all that crap they went through.
And one of my scenes, actually, just because of the power of it, one of the most powerful scenes for me is when, I guess, middle teenage Salim just shoots Mamin. Like, that's really their only way they were going to get out of that situation, and he does it without flinching. That's just, it had to be done, I guess, for the plot, but it really shows, as far as few character develop we get for Salim, that kind of shows some.
Yeah, definitely. Then I like we talked about, the sequence where the game show host gives him the wrong answer in the bathroom, and then when he goes out there and does his own thing and gets it right, because he's not going to be duped by that con artist.
Here's my thing. Prim could not have known at all that he was going to use his 50-50. What if he had used the 50-50 and had eliminated the answer Prim fed him?
I feel like Prim designed it to where if he did 50-50, the one he fed him would
stay. He kept it in there, which is like, talk about a messed up show.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it definitely makes it out to be corrupt.
That will come up in our casting cut in regards to the corruption in that show. Favorite quotes, I'll start off. You know, the two police officers are talking with each other, and they say, "Doctors, lawyers never get past 60,000 rupee. He's won 10 million. What the hell can a slumdog possibly know?" And he's sitting there strung up, and he says, "The answers." And it's great.
It is.
Go ahead.
My favorite quote was when, believe it or not, Salim says, "India is at the center of the world now, brother. And I am at the center of the center."
He thinks he's big stuff, man. He thinks like he's it.
Yeah. Well, I like the view, the cinematography there, and the view as he says it. It's just a cool look at India from that perspective.
One of mine is from the same scene when Jamal gets to the rooftop and he says, you know, like, "You left me." And he's like, "I left a message." And he's like, "There was no message. There was no message." And he's just, this is his brother. And he betrayed him, and betrayal cuts down to the bone.
Oh, the anger and everything's finally coming out. Finally, years worth of being finally able to confront him. So yeah, I felt his rage there. I really did.
We kind of talked about the Rama and Allah quote. So my last one I have is when Salim says, "Shut up." The man with the Colt 45 says, "Shut up." Oh, he
on his own brother.
Yeah, it's but hell, hey, gave him an answer, I guess. It's only like a positive side of that.
Yeah.
Now into the score, composer A.R. Rahman, 5-time nominee. I think what blows my mind, you know, he gets 2 wins for this movie, but how often does a composer get 2 original songs nominated in the same movie, same year?
and normally a musical only.
Yeah.
Honestly, the only time that happens.
He gets this for the ending song and the paper planes, like redux thing with MIA.
I think he won. Did he win for Jaho or no?
Yes. Yeah. He won for that. And then, yeah. So it just crazy. I think it really adds, like, you get the classic Bollywood vibe from the music, but it definitely sets the tone in a lot of scenes, or it definitely appeals to your emotions as some of the story unfolds. I enjoyed the music.
I thought the score was one of the best parts of this film. You know, it fit the tone, fit the flow of it perfectly, like you're saying, the pacing, and it was cool. You know, it blended Bollywood with Hollywood, kind of. So I really did enjoy it.
Even the MIA song, which got nominated with his mix with it, like, it was fun how they added that in, because that's when they're like robbing and doing their hustling and stuff. Into casting cut. Not a lot of possibilities in this, but one that was a big one that I thought interesting is that Danny Boyle wanted to use the actual millionaire game show host from the Indian version, but that man declined. He's also a Bollywood star, but he declined because he said he didn't want to make a connection that the show was actually rigged or that there was corruption on the sets, like the movie kind of hints at, so he turned it down.
I can't say I blame him.
I wonder if he regrets that, though.
Here's my thing. That's such a big industry there, Bollywood and all that. If you're already pretty big in that, I feel like you're not going to sacrifice it for one Hollywood gig. You know what I mean? I feel like you're going to stick to what really got you there. Because, I mean, yeah, Bollywood's, I think it's, what, the second biggest film industry to Hollywood? I'm pretty sure.
Has to be. Yeah. I mean,
right, you think on population alone.
I was going to say your target market is 1/7 of the world immediately.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Issues with the movie. Obviously, a lot of problems with it not being very realistic, but I really don't think they developed characters. Like, you get the three different actors, you get a young Salim, a young Jamal, a young Latika, middle-aged versions of all of them, older versions of all of them, and you don't really get a lot of screen time with them. A movie like Moonlight, I felt an actual bond with him as he grew and had the different, because he had real pat, like, it really showed him changing and what he, you know, and I don't think we got as much of that with this movie. Several of the movies, either he's on the game show set or he's in the police station, and they just jump around so much, there's no development.
That was largely my same complaints. That it's kind of, like I already pointed out, it's not very respectful to India or their culture, or portraying it largely as a slum, and you got to come rags to riches to make your way. But I've kind of voiced my biggest complaint throughout this. I hate Salim as much as Matt Damon's character in The Departed, I'm pretty sure.
What?
Until the only difference being Salim has his slight redemptive arc at the end where Matt Damon didn't.
That's a huge one. Yeah, my only other issue is, and you've touched on it, it's like you have two white British dudes writing a movie about the Indian children from slums. I'm not one to say whether or not I did a service to India. I'm not from India. I know they had a co-director that kind of on set that was from India, but
India wasn't happy. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's like, oh, great, sweet. Show all of this. Any other issues?
That's all I had. It just largely, like Crash, it has not aged too well, or Chicago.
Well, let's get into Greatest Resume Edition. We don't have a lot here. We'll start with Dev Patel. I went with Lion. I love Lion, and like I said, I actually might enjoy Lion more than I like this movie. And he got a Best Actor nomination for that movie.
Was it supporting or actor?
I believe it was actor.
I'm gonna go Lion. Even though I haven't seen it, I've heard from you and many others, it's great. I love his acting talent, and yeah, if he got a nom for it, I think Lion was nominated for Best Picture as well. I may be wrong.
It was nominated for Best Picture. I can get into that.
He hit, you know, the criteria for us right there.
Of course, it's such an ensemble cast. I'm going to have to double check myself on that it may not have been Best Actor. It may have been Best Supporting.
I bet it was Supporting, but either way.
It was Best Supporting. It did have a Best Supporting. Nicole Kidman gets Best Supporting Actress. It got, you know, a Best Picture nom. He didn't win for it, but, you know, he gets a nomination for a category where a movie that now had 6 Oscar nominations.
I will be watching it. I'm excited to now that I know more about it. What about Danny Boyle?
It has to be. He won Best Director. He did the double. It's this movie. I mean, I'm just going to go ahead and tell you that's my same for Beaufoy. It's the same. It's this. This is their career.
Yeah, pretty much. Hats off to him undeservedly, but whatever. That leads us to the loop, too.
The competition, and this one's going to be – this one was tough for me. I have to say, I was on like a 7-movie bubble.
Okay, wow. You know, this one – for me wasn't that hard. And it's going to, you'll see when you see my 5, you'll go, wow, either way, it's a switch up for me. Do you want me to lead off the competition or do you want to start?
Go ahead. Give us some, which one are you going to pick?
I'm going to start strong. I'm going with The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. David Fincher, like I said, it's his first film. He's nominated for Best Director. He gets, you know, a film nominated for Best Picture as well that he directed. Brad Pitt, Cate Blanchett. Brad Pitt gets the nom. Cate Blanchett should have got the nom. We've talked about that before. It's a great movie. I mean, it's based on an F. Scott Fitzgerald's short story. Eric Roth, the fantastic screenwriter that developed Forrest Gump for screen, he wrote the script. And, I mean, it's amazing. Claudio Miranda's the cinematographer. He did Life of Pi, so very talented cinematographer. Got nominated for that. I think, like, the aging effects and the de-aging effects they used in Ben Button, why in the hell did The Irishman not go that route, right? I mean, this movie looks fantastic. It holds up to this day.
12 years before The Irishman.
Exactly, and it's a feat onto itself. The CGI, everything they did with this, all of that, the motion capture, the cameras they use. Obviously, Fincher has shot digital since Zodiac, so it's digital. It's great. I mean, it's a cinematic marvel. I love it. It's a love story, too. It's a love story about time and on. And if you haven't seen it, check it out. If you love Brad Pitt, it's great. That's all I can say.
It's crazy. In a year that had both my favorites, it's Fincher that did one about time and not Nolan. Out of all the movies Nolan's done about
time. Well, Nolan was stuck in a genre that we're going to get into.
I know. It's just, you know, that's always been Nolan's thing is time.
I will tell you, you're right. That's a theme. I will tell you, I did see Ben Button with Mitchell Wayman in theaters. He watched all 3 hours.
Without complaining?
He complained, but McCutcheon was there.
Mitchell, we know you're listening. We love you. Yeah. Just thought we'd throw it in there.
Hey, man. Glad you saw it with me, Mitch.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Frost Nixon. Ron Howard has found his way back into the pod with another nomination. He partners with Peter Morgan, who I would say might most be known for the current series The Crown on Netflix, but he also wrote one of my favorite soccer films, The Damned United, which covers Leeds United during their heyday. It's another Michael Sheen film, and this movie brings together, it's got a great cast, it's got a lot of names that people would recognize: Frank Langella, Michael Sheen, Kevin Bacon, Rebecca Hall, and our guy Sam Rockwell. And it's a story that centers around a British journalist named David Frost, who's played by Michael Sheen, and then President Richard Nixon. And Nixon agrees to do an interview post resignation, which he hadn't done a lot of those, but he thought it could help his reputation. And, you know, the best parts of this movie are the interview scenes. Like, both men dominate the screen and they're dynamite. And it kind of gives you some insight into a topic often lost, you know, in our world, about that we had a president that had to resign because of corruption. And yet, you know, here we are so many years later, and there's so many allegations about corruption again. And it's just, it's an interesting topic. I have to say, upon rewatch, I think it's in Howard's top two. Like, it's a really good movie. It's just the topic, the choice, you know, it's not something that's that interesting to develop a movie around. Sheehan and Langella, they saved the day in it.
It's one I haven't seen, but I do need to watch, as I've appreciated Ron Howard more since Our Beautiful Mind pod.
One of the most powerful scenes in it, and it's one that's like was on the trailer and people would often, and it is a quote contributed to Nixon where he says, "When the president does it, it's not illegal." And that's, it's that whole last interview is great.
Yeah. And I believe it was a play, and Langella acted in the play version, and I think got a Tony Award for it, maybe, or nominated.
Oh yeah. Peter Morgan wrote the play, and then he just did the movie too.
Yeah. That's it. It's always cool when you can do that easy transition. Next in the competition for this year was The Reader. I believe it's a Stephen Daldry film starring Kate Winslet. This is Kate Winslet's first Academy Award win for Best Actress, her first Academy Award, which is insane considering the performances she gave and she had given up to that point. And when I talk about another film here in a minute, when I get into snubs, I kind of question how she didn't win for that over The Reader. But, you know, either way, The Reader is it's a period piece revolving around World War II, where basically she plays a Nazi and falls in love with a younger man. And it's kind of a tale of time as well, and the effects of their relationship, and then also the effects of the war, what the war had on her, and the fact that she was a Nazi and how that doesn't end well for her. And Kate Winslet's fantastic in it. I don't know how it got nominated when I get into the snubs.
Yeah, she's really good. Yeah. And the story is pretty well done. It's just outside of her and that, it isn't something that, it's definitely not a rewatchable. I've got Milk. Been telling you about this movie for years, my friend. A Gus Van Sant film. You may have seen some of the other works of his, like Good Will Hunting, Finding Forrester, or Promised Land. It stars Sean Penn. And it stars, and the award goes to alum Josh Brolin. It's got James Franco, Emil Hirsch, and a young Diego Luna, who you may have watched in Rogue One, who's getting his own spinoff Star Wars show reprising that character. This film won Best Original Screenplay, and it gave Sean Penn his second Best Actor award. And this is a film, it's a biopic about the life of Harvey Milk, who was the first openly gay person to be elected to public office in the United States. He was a gigantic voice in the LGBT community, which at that time, that is all the organization was called. And even mentored another young man named Cleve Jones, who is still active today in the fight with the LGBTQIA+ community. After winning his election, he gets on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. But, and this is, you know, since this is a real story, he's tragically assassinated at a city hall by another member of the board, Frank White, who's played by Josh Brolin. And Penn gives an incredible performance. And in most people's encounter, he really embodies who Harvey Milk was, is a kind-hearted man. It's well-written. It's got a great cast. Obviously a tragic ending, but you will not be disappointed by Penn's performance or an overall story. And at this time, about a topic that was, it was building up steam in American pop culture and just after Brokeback and Americans altogether. I mean, this was a movement of people. It was not going away. They, you know, they wanted their rights, and he was all about fighting for that.
Sean definitely piggybacked off Heath's success and Brokeback, I think, to get his second Oscar. Nothing against Sean Penn, fantastic actor, but I really feel like he rode that wave.
Oh, I mean, it was, I think a lot of people were upset that movie didn't get as many accolades as a lot of people thought in regards to Brokeback. And then the Academy saw this and they're like, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
I will say, I'm going to throw out later someone who should have won that year instead. Stay tuned.
For best actor?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I've got to pick myself. So interesting. Well, let's get into the snubs then, Luke.
Oh, yeah.
It's
exciting. Don't do your first one.
That was going last. Why don't you lead us off, though, on the snubs?
Okay, I'm going to lead off with a more of a lighthearted, wild one. As the show listeners know, I like bringing up our boy, Charlie Kaufman.
Can you quit talking about? No, I'm just kidding.
Syndicate. Hey, New York. This one, it's not as wild as like Eternal Sunshine, but it's got Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it stars him alongside Samantha Morton from Minority Report, Catherine Keener, Michelle Williams, an excellent actress. And yes, it is directed and written by Zach's favorite, Charlie Kaufman. I don't know how to explain this without going on like a 10-minute deep dive, so I'll just say Hoffman plays this theater director who, like several of Kaufman's characters, has a psychosocial issue, psychological issue, and a physical issue. He has all these things that are going wrong with him, but he hits it big and has a great play. But he wants to create his own masterpiece. But he gets so caught up in it and so distracted in it that he actually loses touch of reality. Like, literally cannot tell if he's in reality or if he is making the play. But I will say, Birdman draws a lot of parallels from this movie in that regards of being caught up in a character. I mean, it doesn't go full crazy, but it goes half crazy. Listen, if Kaufman's not your thing, don't watch it. But if you're someone who loves a wild story, it's a wild story. And this will blow your mind. Roger Ebert named it the best film of the decade.
He's a big Kaufman fan, though, so whatever. All right, let me get into Burn After Reading. I'm back with a Coen Brothers film. Yes, Burn After Reading, another Coen Brothers film. Brad Pitt, J. Jonah Jameson. What is his real acting name?
Yeah, J. Jonah Jameson from Spider-Man. Yeah.
What's his acting name, though?
J.K. Simmons.
J.K. Simmons. So, basically, J. Jonah Jameson. He's in this as well. Who else do you have? Oh, George Clooney. Luke did a spoiler on previous pod about it. It's great. It's a classic Coen Brothers dark comedy, but with starring John Malkovich basically in the lead. George Clooney, Brad Pitt. John Malkovich is a CIA agent who is not that important. He's basically forced to retire early, but is writing a memoir, which he leaves in the gym that Brad Pitt works at with Frances McDormand. So you have an ensemble cast, the more names I'm naming, and it just devolves into this insane Washington DC thriller, but not really, because they're all so inept and bad at what they do. It's hilarious. I know Luke's a big fan of this film. I am as well. You get great performances and just great comedy, and everyone's in their A game in this.
The Tilda Swinton and Clooney affair.
She's another one I forgot. Yes. So Clooney's character in this is probably, out of all the Clooney roles he's played, this is the most one I'm just like, wow. Like, he's great, but I'm just like, oh my God. Like, I can never see you playing this type of person.
No, and spoiler alert, but the scene with him and Pitt, I'm not even say what happens, but when Pitt pops out of the closet,
yeah,
is great. Go watch it, folks. Go watch it.
Richard Jenkins too is great. Yes. Well, I work at Hardbody, the manager. So good. Such a good cast.
Oh yeah, and everyone does. Yeah, it's definitely a great Coen, and they pulled in a lot of the same players. I have doubt. Holy smokes. Let me just start off with four names. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Meryl Streep, Amy Adams, and Viola Davis. Like, those are huge names. Hoffman has 4 Academy noms with 1 win. Streep has 21 with 3. Amy Adams has 6 nominations, and Lord only knows why she hasn't won one. And Viola Davis has, like, the acting triple crown. She has an Emmy, a Tony, and an Academy Award. And, Zach, you'll have to answer this for me. Have you ever seen a movie get 4 acting nominations?
I have. Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle.
And, boom! And a screenplay get nominated.
David O. Russell's good at pulling that off, but yeah.
And not get a Best Picture nom. It's mind-blowing to me because I remember the first time I watched this, and I think I even brought this movie up to you when we were in college because, you know, it's directed and written by John Patrick Shanley, who adapted it from his play, which he won a Pulitzer and a Tony for. He already had an Oscar to his name, which was crazy because most of his movies, he did like Joe versus the Volcano and like lighthearted comedies. He did Congo, which I know Mitchell loves as he's out there listening.
I didn't realize he did that.
But the topic at hand here is what makes this movie such a gut-wrenching watch. The film takes place at a Catholic school in the Bronx during the 1960s. Streep plays, you know, the principal of this school, and she suspects that the father of the parish, played by Hoffman, is molesting young boys at the school. And a younger nun, played by Adams, she witnesses some events that kind of implicate that that's what's going on. And, you know, it's called Doubt because a lot of the movie opens with this great, like, scene of Hoffman giving a speech or giving a sermon that deals with doubt in the Christian faith. But Streep, she wants him out of there, but she doesn't have the concrete evidence. So she even interviews the young black boy's mother, who's played by Davis, but she doesn't want the boy to be interviewed or for anything to come out. Because in the 1960s, she kind of hinted already that she thought her son was gay and she didn't want him to get thrown out of the school and she didn't want the father to be embarrassed. So she doesn't want to pursue it. It's powerful. It's intense. And, you know, at times it's disturbing because, you know, this is a sensitive topic. For anyone who's watched Spotlight, I would say that this shows what they were investigating. But way before they got to the concrete evidence that they got, you know, watch some terrific acting, some great writing convey a truly brutal topic.
That's a great parable to Luke to connect those two films. And yeah, I love Doubt. It's fantastic. Like, a tough subject matter, but the performances are so good. And you see why all 4 were nominated. They carry the film.
Oh, when she forces him out, when she lies to kind of coerce him.
How did she not win for this?
He's crying. Like, he's breaking down on it.
Well, Meryl, Amy, and Phil blew me away in this, but how did Meryl not win for this? I'm sorry. Obviously, it was time to
voter fatigue.
It was time to give Kate hers, but it's when you look at the ones, and I'm not, never mind. I won't get into this tangent, but anyway, next snub. I have Revolutionary Road. Luke, look who's back on the pod alum, Sam Mendes, along with his wife at the time, Kate Winslet, and then starring Leonardo DiCaprio, their first reunion since Titanic. I know how you feel about this movie, Luke. I feel the same. We adore it. We love it. It's a fantastic 1950s period piece about a relationship, a married couple, whose relationship is essentially disintegrating. They're falling apart. You know, Leo's the husband. He's making some bad choices as far as engaging in affairs. His wife is tired of being a homemaker and the monotony of life and just raising their kids and kind of wants to get back to their dreams of when they were younger. And it just kind of takes off from there. Roger Deakins shot it, obviously, as he does every Sam Mendes film pretty much. And it's beautiful. It's beautifully acted. It's a sad love tragedy in a sense. Michael Shannon gets nominated for his performance. He's great in it. And then I don't know how Kate and Leo didn't get a nom for, like I said, I don't know how Kate didn't get a nom for this. And Leo is really good in this as well. And then you have a couple other great supporting performances. Kathy Bates, doesn't she play Michael Shannon's mother?
Hopper.
That's who I was trying. I can't.
Harbor.
Dennis Harbor. Yes, plays a married couple, a friend of theirs who Winslet basically has a short affair with. Yeah, I do remember him. Shep is his name.
Yeah, because God.
It's a great movie. Like, what can I say? Tragic ending, tragic love story, you know, tragic story of marriage, tragic consequences, but it's a period piece, so well acted. Just Sam Mendes is just one of those directors who, it's like when you watch his films, it's like you're looking at a painting or a photograph from that era, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's like a Norman Rockwell painting, but like...
Like he did on Road to Perdition, but then he just switched to the 50s.
Yeah, it's great. I that's another one I own, and who knows how many times I've watched it, which is odd because it's so gut wrenching. The next one I have, The Wrestler. So Darren Aronofsky, he does Requiem for a Dream, Black Swan, Noah, Mother, and it stars Mickey Rourke and Marissa Tomei, and both were nominated for their performances. And here's my hot take, a very hot take. But I think Mickey Rourke gave one of those like once in a lifetime performances playing Randy the Ram, and it was deserving of an Oscar. He plays a professional wrestler who was once famous in the 80s, but now he's past his prime, but he desperately tries to live off his past fame. He does like these backyard wrestling gigs, you know, all the while he's battling this debilitating health. And like, this is Mickey Rourke's like life, because he had some fame in the 80s and they drifted away and they slowly got back in the light for a few moments. The work he put in to do all the physical parts of this role is amazing. Like, you could have fooled me. You could have told me that Mickey Rourke was a WWE wrestler at some point in his life, and I actually would have bought it. You know, on top of all the wrestling stuff though, is that, you know, he prepares for this huge rematch, and he has this moments where he's having to reconnect with his daughter, and he's trying to reconnect. He's trying to push that. And his daughter's played by Hello Westworld, Evan Rachel Wood. And The Wrestler is just, it's thrilling. It's heartbreaking. It's utterly captivating. Just all that Rourke put into it. He really gave everything he had. And Marissa Tomei's no slouch either. Like, she's an Academy Award winning actress. I would say for anyone out there who hasn't seen this, he does his Sly Stallone Rocky, but on like wrestling steroids. Like, he kills this as being Randy the Ram. I love it. And what really blew my mind in the research here is this number, 98. 98 is its Rotten Tomatoes score. The highest of the year, the highest of, for people out there, I own this. And if you want a copy, if you want the copy of it, you can follow us on Instagram at And the Award Goes to Podcast, and I will mail it to you. That's how good it is.
A couple thoughts to add to that film. At the time, I wanted Mickey Rourke to win the Oscar for that film. I loved it. I love Darren Aronofsky. He's very dark filmmaker, but so talented, because, you know, Black Swan is one of my all-time favorites. Yeah, when I watched this film, I felt like I was on that same emotional journey as Randy, and I was just devastated. The ending is an all-timer, the fade to black that it does. Yeah, it's unbelievable movie. I'm not surprised it's 98%, but this leads us, Luke, to our last snub. Oh man, how do I even talk about this movie? The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan's most prestigious film, maybe, and that's saying a lot when you talk about Christopher Nolan. The Dark Knight is a sequel in the Christian Bale Batman franchise, the Nolan trilogy, that many consider the greatest sequel of all time, as good as Godfather Part II, easily, right in that same realm. And I'm one of those people. This movie, when I watch it, I've seen it probably 20 times, maybe more. I've seen it a lot. It's perfection, and from everything, from camera work, the performances, the late, great Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker, you know, iconic in every sense of the word, well-deserved. and Michael Caine, Morgan Freeman, you know, Christian Bale, he's the best Batman ever. He's convincing. He's believable. And it's Wally Feiser when he was still being Nolan's cinematographer. He was one of the great cinematographers. I wish he'd go back to that and quit trying to direct. So it's just, it's a film, man. The aerial shots, the shots of the city, of Chicago, of Hong Kong, the camera work, Heath. I mean, when you think of this film, you think of Heath. I always think of Heath because it's just his menacing, chaotic, insane performance, but also just how well he told this story and how he blended Aaron Eckhart's character of Harvey Dent into it, you know, just on and telling a story that, you know, he kind of modeled after Heat in a lot of ways, telling the story of a city, a showdown between two men. And for, it was nominated for 8 Academy Awards for being nominated for 8 Academy Awards, not getting a Best Picture, Best Director nod. You know, that's insane, obviously. But this film, this is the reason why we now have 10 Best Picture nominees at the Oscars. I fully believe that. I think that's beyond true. The Dark Knight paved the way for that.
Yeah, before we get to our 5, just a couple shout-outs for our fans. One that we didn't really get to discuss, but we're going to throw it out, is WALL-E for the animated film. That was a terrific movie this year. And another one that I recently watched, because Zach and I are both fans of the television series 000, is Gamora. It will be completely in subtitles for you, but it's a well done, just like the show. Do you have any other shout outs?
That was all for that year.
All right. We'll get into the 5. Give us yours first.
Okay. Ben Button is, so this is new for me. Ben Button is the only Best Picture nominee in my 5 I'm going to keep that the Academy nominated. Dark Knight, obviously, is going to go in there for me. I felt like Revolutionary Road deserved another nomination. I love Burn After Reading. I think that's one of the best dark comedies of all time. And I think it's just Coen Brothers' perfection in the ensemble cast. So I think that deserved a nom. And then I think Doubt really deserves a nom based off those performances and the precedent you said it set as far as, you know, Oscars history. What are your 5, sir?
I've got 4 of the same. So I too had, obviously, Doubt, had Rev Road, had Ben Button, and had Dark Knight. Our only difference, instead of Burn After Reading, I went with The Wrestler solely because of the points I talked about. And that's what made this tough for me, because I love Burn After Reading. You know, I enjoy Slumdog. I just don't think it's 5. And I do like Frost Nixon as well. But, you know, it was the Burn After Reading and The Wrestler. And obviously I love Milk, but I went with The Wrestler because of Mickey Rourke. We'll get into who deserved the award. I guess I'll lead us off. You kind of touched on this movie. It's Dark Knight. Christopher Nolan created a masterpiece, and I don't care where you are from or what you're interested in. This is not your normal comic book movie. It has an outstanding performance by the late Heath Ledger. It has iconic actors in Michael Caine, Morgan Freeman, and Gary Oldman. You have the best Batman ever to don the cowl in Christian Bale. It's the best movie from this year. You could poll 1,000 people and list every movie we've discussed, and I would bet the house that they would pick this as their favorite from that list. And it's not just because it's Batman. Like, it's visually stunning, like you talked about. The sound and the editing is top-notch. The storytelling is almost perfect. Listen, like you said, it got nominated for 8, and you want to know why it didn't win Best Visual Effects? Is because they did so many things without using computer-generated things. They literally flipped a truck. They literally blew up an abandoned hospital. Like, Nolan went full Nolan with this. It's the greatest Batman movie of our lifetime. And it made over $1 billion. And it wasn't because people were flocking to necessarily see Batman, because a lot of people weren't fans of Batman Begins. I mean, I was, but it's because of the quality. like, there's been several live action Batmans, but none even touched this. Of like, it's how it's shot and how it's mixed. I mean, you watch the Burton one compared to this. Burton's is comic booky. This is so realistic. On a rewatchability scale, it's a 10. And let's be honest, like you said, it changed the Academy forever because of the uproar that had to do with this. From now on, our show, we're going to have 10 nominees, and it's because of this. And this is, we're talking about the Academy that changes nothing, and it changed everything because of this movie. I love it, and the award goes to Dark Knight.
Yeah, I believe you said it best. The Dark Knight, far and away the winner. Nah, it wasn't. This was, like I told you, this was the easiest for me to pick of all our awards goes to. This was far and away the easiest. I did not have to debate about it at all. No one was close.
Yeah, it's a classic that holds up. You know, it will hold up for a long, long time. And speaking of great movies, next time we'll be breaking down the 82nd Academy Award winner for Best Picture, The Hurt Locker. And we will transition to 10 nominees. I'm Luke Shoemaker.
And I'm Zach King.
You just listened to And the Award Goes To. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. आजा आजा जिंदे शामी आने के तले आजा जरीवार